The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, here we are again. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, I was told that if not yesterday morning, the day before, the night before, we had a huge thunderstorm in Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters campus, and a lightning strike actually took out our radio tower. So the over-the-air signal was out, and it still may be out for all I know. But Andrew Locher told me yesterday that it didn't affect the live stream. So we're thankful for the live stream, which takes this message all around the world over the internet, live, and then again on KPCG when it's replayed a few times through the day. And then, of course, the podcast that we put up on thetrumpet.com or at KPCG or through iTunes or wherever. You can certainly listen to the program that way as well. But for those local listeners who like to listen to the program, those heading into headquarters perhaps the last few minutes before 8 a.m., it may be a little more of a challenge today with no signal going out. Well, we've got a lot to get to on today's program. Coming up in the second segment, we'll be taking you back to March 30th, 1981, the day John Hinckley Jr., very nearly assassinated U.S. President Ronald Reagan. You may have seen some reports about Hinckley in the news of late, so we'll be looking at that coming up in the second segment, and also more on Mr. Reagan's presidency. But first, more details on this very, very bad deal.
Well, this is a bad deal. It's a very bad deal.
That, of course, was Prime Minister Netanyahu from March of 2015. Seems like such a long time ago, when he was ridiculed and castigated and made fun of. He really was a lone voice coming into the deal, a very bad deal, as he described it. And, of course, the Obama administration was up in arms. Many in Congress were as well. The international leftist press, very much against Prime Minister Netanyahu. That was from March 2015. The parameters of the deal were finalized by July of 2015, and then it was made official on January the 16th, earlier this year. And all year, we've been hearing more and more about the details of this bad deal. The New York Post, yesterday, it says here, look, there's another one of those secret Iran deal side agreements that President Obama says don't exist. It says it on the president's website, the White House website, bragging about this deal, saying, look, everything's out in the open. We're completely transparent, like I covered yesterday. There were no side deals, nothing secretly done, nothing. And now we hear about more secret arrangements made with respect to this deal. The Institute for Science and International Security, headed by former UN Weapons Inspector David Albright, just issued a report citing three technical concessions Obama and his negotiating partners made to Iran without telling the public. This comes from the most transparent administration in history, keep in mind. No, none is as dramatic as the revelation in July that another secret side deal relaxes key restrictions on Iran's nuclear program in a decade rather than 15 years. Or the earlier disclosure that Iran gets to self-inspect It's Parchin Military Base. Remember that one? I think that was back at the tail end of last year, if I recall. They get to self-inspect. It says, but the newly disclosed exemptions and loopholes will help Iran be far more prepared to sprint its way to nukes when it so chooses. The New York Post says here, more important, they were all enacted for one particular reason. Without them, according to Albright's report, Tehran wouldn't have met last January's deadline. That's the January 16th deadline. Iran wouldn't have met it for compliance with the public requirements of the deal. They wouldn't have made the deadline, and so the White House said, well, we'll waive some of these demands, and we'll go ahead and bring us to the finish line, and the sanctions can be lifted, and you can have all of the cash that you're seeking. It was all dependent on that January 16th deadline. And the U.S., so eager to get it done, so eager to help their new partner relax some of those strictures, and did it secretly. Isn't it amazing? My father's made this point recently. God keeps drawing our attention to what happened on January the 16th, earlier this year, the 30-year anniversary of Herbert Armstrong's death, by the way. 30 years since Satan the devil and his demons were cast down to this earth and confined to this earth. All of these details about this very bad deal. The New York Post says here, the secret deals let Iran exceed the stated limit on how much low-enriched uranium, which can be purified to weapons-grade material, it retains. They also allow it to keep operating radiation containment chambers and to store abroad, but under Tehran's control, the heavy water stocks needed for nuclear weapons development. Yet even as President Obama bends over backward to accommodate Iran, thereby freeing up billions for possible terrorist funding, Tehran keeps testing ballistic warheads and engaging in clandestine efforts to acquire nuclear technology and equipment. It says here, finally, yet one more sign our president sold the American people a dangerous bill of goods. One more sign that this administration sold the American people a dangerous, dangerous bill of goods. That was the New York Post take on this revelation yesterday from David Albright's institution, the Institute for Science and International Security. Reuters also reported on this. There was a video embedded within the report in which the author of the article, Jonathan Landay, he gave this report, clip one.
I was able to review a report coming out this week that says Iran was given exemptions by the United States and its negotiating partners from certain restrictions in the Iran nuclear deal. In particular, one of these exemptions gave it a pass on the amount of low-enriched uranium it's allowed to have in its facilities. How much it actually has in the facilities is not apparent, which is why there is concern over this issue. The United States and its negotiating partners, known as the P5 plus one, secretly agreed to give Iran these exemptions so that Iran could meet the deadline for the beginning of the lifting of financial sanctions that were crushing its economy. Meeting the deadline to begin the lifting of sanctions was incredibly crucial to President Hassan Rouhani of Iran, who basically made his election platform the lifting of sanctions. So there appears to have been a political aspect to the granting of these secret waivers.
Secret waivers that were secretly agreed to behind the scenes during these confidential negotiations. Some in the left-wing press have given a little bit of cover to the administration. I noted those yesterday that have pointed out, point blank, that this is the most secretive administration they've ever worked with. And yet still, the Washington Post, even Reuters, You heard the report there. I'll read a bit from his written report in just a second. But some in the media putting the scare quotes around secret as if, well, it wasn't really a secret, or that's debatable. The Washington Post says here, Albright is a physicist who participated in UN's weapons inspections in Iraq and has become a watchdog over the deal that imposes curbs on Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Albright has repeatedly raised doubts about whether it is being implemented as promised. So they're not real sure about Albright because he's been such an outspoken critic of the deal. It says here, under the agreement, notice this, even with the Post providing cover, there's revealing details. It says, under the agreement, the Joint Commission's deliberations are confidential. Although the commission could make decisions public, it has not. As a result, it is difficult to verify the criticism or the administration's denials. The White House came out yesterday with strong denials. But here's the Washington Post, the middleman, giving space to both sides in the argument. Well, Albright's been an outspoken critic. We can't confirm for sure what he's saying, his confidential sources. And we can't confirm the administration's denials because you have to understand it's all confidential. They could make it known. They could make it public, but they choose not to. Why? If you're dealing with the most transparent administration in the history of America, really, you would think this would be quite easy to get to the bottom of. Transparency, openness? Not hardly. Not hardly. As we covered yesterday, there's lots of information out there. But the most important information is concealed. It's withheld. Because they don't want that out there. And so you, for sure, you could go on the White House website right now and read a lot of information about the Iran nuclear deal. But we keep finding out all of these details, these secret details that reveal just how bad the deal is. Reuters says the group's president, David Albright, a former UN weapons inspector and co-author of the report, declined to identify the officials, and Reuters could not independently verify the report's assertions. Same thing as the Post said. It says further, State Department spokesman John Kirby said that Iran was not granted exceptions to limits on low-enriched uranium or heavy water that would allow them to have a usable amount of material in excess of what they're supposed to have towards the production of fissile material. Don't worry, they haven't been granted any exceptions, and the reporters pressed him. It says here he repeatedly declined to directly address the reporters, the report's findings on the exemptions, saying the Joint Commission's work is confidential. And so the State Department comes out strong yesterday. No, they haven't been granted any exceptions. Well, what about this, 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 and this in the report? Well, I can't comment on that. It's confidential. It's confidential. Yesterday we had a program titled Presidential Transparency and the Spirit of Antiochus. We went through Daniel 8. Daniel 8, talking about this demon army given to this Antiochus figure who cast the truth down to the ground. An individual coming on the scenes through deceit, lies, and flatteries, pretending to be someone he's not. And my father, to quote America Under Attack again, we gave you one of these quotes yesterday, page 11. It says, when Satan was cast down, that's 1986, he immediately went after spiritual Israel. That was his first target, but he didn't stop there. After that, he directed his attack against physical Israel. Who is that? Specifically, it's three of the modern nations that descended from the biblical nation of Israel, chiefly the United States, Britain, and the Jewish state. That's who he went after, Satan. He went after the church first, and as I explained this week, it happened so fast. I mean, here at the point of Mr. Armstrong's death in January of 1986, the church, the message coming from that church, it was poised and ready to go right around the world with that final blast of God's true gospel message, warning this world, those three nations in particular, of what's headed, what's ahead, just ahead of us. And yet within 5 or 6 years, well, it was just any old church. It had rejected all of the foundational doctrines that Herbert Armstrong taught. It had rejected Mystery of the Ages. It had gone off television. The Plain Truth circulation was whittled down to just a few thousand after going out to 8 million. The college was preparing to close up its doors, close up shop. Everything's over. That happened in the span of 6 or 7 years. Page 18, America Under Attack. That army of demons is still around. We made this point yesterday. That host given to him against the daily, given to that church leader in order to bring down the church, in order to destroy the church, that army of demons is still around. They wrecked the church, my father wrote, and then they moved on to other areas. Now they're seeking to bring down nations. Page 41, further on, in America Under Attack. My father says, but I do know about the devil, and I know he's doing everything he can to sink America. And I've seen him use a man at the top, an Antiochus, to bring down an organization. And I'm watching as this government takes one step after another that is weakening this country and hastening the fulfillment of some of the most terrifying prophecies in the Bible. He says, and I know that the devil, who is a liar and who hates law, is behind that. See, who is behind this spirit of deceit, these lies and these deceptions? I know that the devil is behind that. That's what my father wrote in America Under Attack this morning while I was getting ready for work. I was taken aback somewhat by this comment made by Mark Levin, who has a radio program in the United States. He said this, I think, about 20 minutes or so into his program from, this would have been from last night in the United States, clip two.
Obama believes America is bad. The communists who surrounded him in his youth told him America's bad. Told him America is an old slave state, that America is colonialist and imperialist, that but for America, so many people all over the world would be prosperous and living in harmony and happiness. Never before have we had a president of the United States who seeks to destroy the country from within.
Never before have we had a president who seeks to destroy the country from within. From within. Now that, as I said, that got my attention. I thought, wow, good for him. Good for him, sounding the alarm. If you follow some conservative blogs like I do, just in looking through headlines and commentary on the news, you'll see little snippets from radio shows, Mark Levin, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, whoever else, Sean Hannity. And the ones they draw attention to, I mean, that in itself is revealing. I guess I can go look later today and see if any of these blogs pick up that particular statement. I suspect that they won't. Because, well, he's just kind of popping off with commentary that maybe goes a little bit too far. But, you know, it's not even really that interesting. Really, what interests us is Donald Trump and the Republican Party. What interests us, now, if there's a fight between Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity, that's worth covering. We will play you the sound bites. We will play you the sound bites. This is a compelling story. Infighting in the Republican Party. Politics. What Donald Trump thinks about this. Whether or not he's a true conservative. And yet, look at that statement. You think about that statement. Never before have we had a president of the United States who seeks to destroy the country from within. What does that mean? How will this end? Well, America Under Attack, our Ezekiel booklet, my father's booklet on that prophet, I mean, we have a lot that we can supply you with. The new one we've produced on making America great. Well, there's a strong message in that as well. And, you know, coming back to that comment, as strong as it is, it's spot on. But as bad as it's getting for the United States, and quite a few commentators can see, it's bad. It's bad. They're panicking. But how many do you hear taking it a step further and actually talking about the sins of our people? Now, that's not a popular message to proclaim. You don't hear it. As bad as it gets, well, there's always some leader to put the blame on. Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, whoever the leader happens to be, or whoever the top contender happens to be. Or maybe the problem is a political party, or maybe the problem is Fox News or CNN or BBC or media bias. But what about the sins of the people? What about the fact that, as my father brings out in America Under Attack, and, well, in some of the most recent articles he's written, America's Real Enemy, he goes through some of the very things you just heard in that short clip from Levin. The communist influence and background in this administration, where it's headed, the lawlessness. And yet, as my father brings out in that article, we have the leaders we have today. They're there as a reflection of our character as a people. And then look at this election cycle. What a reflection on the United States of America. Ezekiel 33 speaks of the watchman warning. Watch and warn. In that prophet, the booklet, and my father's booklet on Ezekiel, he goes through this passage here in some detail, the first six verses, referring to this political watchman. And my father says in that prophet that certainly Winston Churchill fits this section of Scripture as well as anybody. The watchman who, well, after the people see the sword coming, they set him up for their watchman. They select the man. The people do. And so Churchill came along. I mean, they would have preferred Neville Chamberlain or someone else, some other appeaser. But when it was clear that Hitler was going to devour the continent and the world, in fact, then the people of Britain woke up at the very last possible moment. And they set for themselves this watchman who fought back, who saved the West. Verse 7, though, it says, "So you, O son of man, I've set you a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me." Now, as you transition into verse 7 and the verses that follow, You see that it's no longer talking about, this time around, a watchman that the people set, but it's someone that God sets. I've set you a watchman unto the house of Israel. And so the setting here dramatically shifts to the end time, the time we're living in right now. And God says to his watchmen, you send them warning from me this time. Well, Churchill was out there warning for sure. And as great of a leader as he wasn't warning the people of Britain from God. That's the way it will play out, though, this time. There is going to be a watchman. A warning will go out. But there is no political savior this time around. Jacinius' Bible study aid says about this watchman to look out, bending forward or in order to view. He's out, he's stretching and straining, making sure he's seeing what's happening. Look at what's happening to our nations. Look at the decline that has set in. Here's another little clip from that same program from Mark Levin, clip 3.
A little over 100 years ago or so, the most powerful nation on the face of the earth was Great Britain. In one century, less than one century, it lost that status. The sun never set on the British Empire. That's what they used to say. Now they say the sun is setting on the British Empire, such as it is. A nation overrun with foreigners who refuse to assimilate, many of whom seek to destroy that nation from within. A nation that is so obsessed with socialism, it can't find its way out of its box.
That makes you wonder if he's read through some of the United States and Britain in prophecy. Mr. Armstrong, back in the 1940s, back in the 1950s, back in the 1960s, talking about the sun setting on the British Empire. And it happened so fast. And it didn't send the world into all of these thunder strikes. Because the transition of power moved to its brother nation, the United States of America. But going back to Britain and its power, the greatest empire this world has ever seen, 100 years ago, Britain pretty much ruled the world. And look at little England today. Do you think America is going to be a superpower from here on out as China devours the South China Sea and now says, look on a map and see how massive that sea lane is. It's not even a lane. It's just a massive swath of territory. And China's helping themselves, saying, this is our area now. We're going to control this. And all of the trillions and trillions of dollars of goods that pass through here. Iran's racing for the bomb. Russia's devouring Ukraine bit by bit. We wait for the Antiochus type to come out of the heart of Europe. And as we do, look at the decline that's set in the once great and mighty nation of the United States. Again, that was spot on. Decline has set in. But what about the sins of the people? I mean, we can't even heed a warning that should have been obvious from Benjamin Netanyahu back in March of 2015. I played the short clip right at the start. Here's a little bit more from that speech, March 3rd, clip 6.
This deal has two major concessions. One, leaving Iran with a vast nuclear program. And two, lifting the restrictions on that program in about a decade. That's why this deal is so bad. It doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb. It paves Iran's path to the bomb.
It paves Iran's path to the bomb. And now we're seeing all of the details coming out about this very bad deal. But no one listened to that warning. That was a political warning. No one listened to that in 2015. He was made fun of and ridiculed. And Israel's pretty quiet right now. Who knows what the prime minister's thinking? But we move on. All the details come out. And still there's the lies, the obfuscation, the deception. We said, no, there's nothing fishy going on here. No secret points to this deal. Well, what about this, this, and this, and this? Oh, that's confidential. We can't cover that with you. Sorry. God says here in Ezekiel 33, when I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die if you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way. That's what's missing from these few commentators that have enough sense to know that America's being destroyed from within, that America is in the midst of a shocking decline. Warn the wicked of his way, that the wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the wicked of his way and turn from it, to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul, God says, to his work, his church. You sound the alarm, you give the warning. And if they don't respond, well, then at least you've done your job. Warn in love. Warn in love about what's happening, about what's coming. It says here in verse 10, does this not reflect God's love? Verse 10, therefore, O son of man, speak to the house of Israel. Thus you speak, saying, if our transgressions and our sins be upon us, and we pine away in them, how should we then live? Say to them, as I live, says the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn. That the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn you from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? It's on us, isn't it? To turn to God. My father writes in the booklet, Ezekiel, the end time prophet, it says, God, through his watchman today, pleads with America, Britain, and modern Judah, specifically to turn. A powerful message is being sent out to Israel and the world. Israel must turn to God, or our nations will die. You can read the rest of the chapter there, particularly the verses toward the end, talking about when the land will be made most desolate, and then how that quite a few people, even some in God's lukewarm Laodicean church, will be tuning in, listening to the Key of David, listening to programs like this, perhaps, viewing the trumpet.com, assembling together to hear the word of the eternal, as it says in verse 30. Verse 31, and they come unto you as the people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness. It says in verse 32 that we're like a lovely song, pleasant to hear. They love the words, but they won't do them. In other words, they won't turn. They won't turn to God in repentance. But that doesn't stop God's work. That doesn't stop God's watchman, God's servant, from sounding the alarm. Verse 33 says, and when this comes to pass, lo, it will come. Then shall they know that a prophet has been among them. See, when the prophecies come to pass, then they'll know then they'll know that was God's message. That was God's warning. That was God's watchman. That was the watchman God selected. That was the message God sent through his watchman. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
You may have seen news of John Hinckley Jr. being released from his psychiatric hospital. He's been there since 1982 after attempting to assassinate President Reagan. He's being released, and he'll be returning to his mother's home in Virginia. The shooting happened back in March of 1981. In 1982, Hinckley was acquitted by a federal jury that found him not guilty by reason of insanity. And so since that time, since 82, he's been confined to this government psychiatric hospital. And now he's out. The Washington Post reports Hinckley was 25 when he wounded Reagan. White House Press Secretary James Brady, Secret Service Agent Tim McCarthy, and D.C. Police Officer Thomas Delahunty, with six exploding Devastator bullets from a .22 caliber pistol. All survived the 1981 attack, but Brady was left paralyzed by a shot to his head and spent years before his death in 2014 advocating gun control. The Post had to throw that in there. After Brady's death, by the way, the Virginia medical examiner ruled that it was a homicide, saying that the death, even though it happened years after the shooting, he believed it was directly related to the shooting. Well, going back to that March day in 1981, Reagan was shot as he was leaving the Washington, D.C. Hilton just less than 3 months into his presidency. Just a new president coming on the scene. And some of you older timers probably remember it well when it hit the airwaves, when the news covered this shocking event. I remember it myself, even though I was a little boy at the time, 11 years old. Reagan coming out of the Hilton, waving to the crowd, and then shots ringing out. And Secret Service agent Jerry Parr shoving Reagan in the back into the president's limousine. He did it as soon as he heard the first shot. And at first, No one thought Reagan was hit. Mr. Reagan didn't think so, and Jerry Parr, who jumped into the president's limousine, didn't think so either. And so Parr shouted to the driver, get back to the White House right away. And Reagan was in pain, but he thought it was from the shove. He wrote this in his diary, I felt a blow in my upper back that was unbelievably painful. I was sure he'd broken my rib, the Secret Service agent. The car took off. I sat up on the edge of the seat, almost paralyzed by pain. Then I began coughing up blood, which made both of us think, yes, I had broken a rib, and it had punctured a lung. So still, they didn't think that he had been shot. So when Parr saw the blood and the president coughing up blood, he told the driver to change plans and to instead go to George Washington University Hospital. And that decision ended up saving Reagan's life. He was losing a lot of blood at the hospital. The doctors, of course, discovered that he had in fact been hit. Apparently the .22 caliber bullet ricocheted off of the armored vehicle, and in the process of that hitting the car, it flattened out from that impact and then sliced its way through Reagan's flesh, entering in, I think, around his shoulder in the back, and going all the way to the middle of his chest area, stopping just short of his heart. So once it was discovered that he had been hit, they decided very quickly to operate to remove the bullet while he was awaiting his operation, kind of coming in and out of consciousness after losing so much blood. He was there in the hospital room. His wife, Nancy, rushed in, and President Reagan heard the commotion and removed the oxygen mask covering his mouth, and he said, honey, I forgot to duck. I forgot to duck. And when his three top aides made it to the hospital room, Reagan smiled at them and asked, who's minding the store? Well, they wheeled him down the hallway into the operating room, and while surrounded by a team of doctors, just before he was to be put under, as they say, Reagan looked at that team of doctors and said, I hope you're all Republicans. The head doctor's response to that was, today, Mr. President, we're all Republicans. Well, obviously, Reagan recovered. He stayed in the hospital for nearly 2 weeks, and he didn't return to the political arena until another 2 weeks after that. April 28th, 1981, he came before Congress. This was a nationally televised speech before a joint session of Congress, and in this speech, he was going to discuss his economic recovery program, but being that this was his first public speech after the tragic event, he prefaced the speech with these remarks about the shooting. This is clip 4.
Will you permit me to digress for a moment from the all-important subject of why we must bring government spending under control and reduce tax rates? I'd like to say a few words directly to all of you and to those who are watching and listening tonight, because this is the only way I know to express to all of you on behalf of Nancy and myself our appreciation for your messages, your flowers, and most of all, your prayers, not only for me, but for those others who fell beside me. The warmth of your words, the expression of friendship, and yes, love, meant more to us than you can ever know. You have given us a memory that we'll treasure forever. And you've provided an answer to those few voices that were raised saying that what happened was evidence that ours is a sick society. The society we heard from is made up of millions of compassionate Americans and their children from college age to kindergarten. As a matter of fact, as evidence of that, I have a letter with me. The letter came from Peter Sweeney. He's in the second grade in the Riverside School in Rockville Center. And he said, I hope you get well quick, or you might have to make a speech in your pajamas. And he added a postscript. P.S., if you have to make a speech in your pajamas, I warned you. Well, sick societies don't produce men like the two who recently returned from outer space. Sick societies don't produce young men like Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy, who placed his body... placed his body between mine and the man with the gun simply because he felt that's what his duty called for him to do. Sick societies don't produce dedicated police officers like Tom Delahanty. Or able and devoted public servants like Jim Brady.
Of course, all references to the individuals who had been shot that day in Washington, D.C., March 30th, 1981. That was Reagan's humor and optimism at its best. He was known for his optimism, that's for sure. He believed in the wisdom of the founders and the Constitution. He believed in the American people. He believed in the ability of the American people to turn it around after a disastrous decade, the 1970s. He believed in the American work ethic. And with respect to that assassination attempt and his recovery and the outpouring of response from average Americans, and the courage of police officers like Tom Delahanty, he did see a lot of good. He saw a lot of compassion. He saw a lot of heroic acts. He saw a lot of, yes, love. But that said, if you look at the entire presidency there through most of the 80s, President Reagan certainly had his moments as well where he voiced concern about the direction of the country morally and spiritually. I'll let you see a bit of that in just a second with another clip. But let me take you again back to that time period, March of 1981, this life-changing experience for President Reagan. He wrote in his diary a few days after the assassination attempt, saying, "Getting shot hurts." I think he meant that to be somewhat of an understatement, perhaps more of his humor was showing through. He said, "Still, my fear was growing because no matter how hard I tried to breathe, it seemed I was getting less and less air. I focused on that tiled ceiling and prayed." This was when he was in the hospital. "But I realized," he said, "I couldn't ask for God's help, while at the same time I felt hatred for the mixed-up young man who had shot me. I began to pray for his soul and that he would find his way back to the fold." I opened my eyes once to find Nancy there. I pray I'll never face a day when she isn't there. Of all the ways God has blessed me, giving her to me is the greatest and beyond anything I can ever hope to deserve. For her part, Nancy Reagan, she wrote in her diary, "Nothing can happen to my Ronnie. My life would be over." That was her response to the assassination attempt. "Nothing can happen to my Ronnie. My life would be over." I noticed recently, by the way, that Hollywood has already produced a movie about the Barack and Michelle Obama love story. If they ever get around to Ronald and Nancy Reagan, they might actually find a pretty compelling script. After his near-death experience on March 30th, 1981, President Reagan felt a greater sense of responsibility than ever before. He believed God saved his life. And so this trial, it really helped him to heighten his sense of mission. Here it happened, not even 3 months into his presidency. Again, he wrote in his diary, "Whatever happens now, I owe my life to God and will try to serve him in every way I can." That was the United States president about 35 years ago. That's how that shooting impacted him. That's how he reacted to it. "Whatever happens now, I owe my life to God and will try to serve him in every way I can." Now, coming back to those moments, you heard the optimism, you heard the praise, you heard his reaction to the overwhelming response he received from the American people. But there were moments, as I say, when he did voice concern about the direction of the United States of America. And one of those moments was about a year, a little less than a year, after the shooting. This was at the annual National Prayer Breakfast there at the White House, I assume. This is President Reagan's remarks at that prayer breakfast.
"I've always believed that we were, each of us, put here for a reason, that there is a plan, somehow a divine plan for all of us. I know now that whatever days are left to me belong to him. I also believe this blessed land was set apart in a very special way. A country created by men and women who came here not in search of gold, but in search of God. They would be free people, living under the law with faith in their Maker and their future. Sometimes it seems we've strayed from that noble beginning, from our conviction that standards of right and wrong do exist and must be lived up to. God, the source of our knowledge, has been expelled from the classroom. He gives us his greatest blessing, life, and yet many would condone the taking of innocent life. We expect him to protect us in a crisis, but turn away from him too often in our day-to-day living. I wonder if he isn't waiting for us to wake up."
That's President Ronald Reagan, February 4th, 1982. You can see this is months after the assassination attempt. You can see his mission, as it was all the more clear after what had happened. I know now that whatever days are left to me, they belong to him. And then speaking more broadly about the course America was on, it seems like we've strayed from that noble beginning. from that conviction that there's right and wrong standards, that God is the source of our knowledge, that God is our educator, that He gives us blessings and life. He protects us. It seems we've strayed from that, Mr. Reagan said in 1982. I wonder if He isn't waiting for us to wake up. Well, He wasn't a perfect president. He wasn't a perfect man. There's a lot He didn't understand about God's purpose and plan, of course. But what a difference. What a difference. 34, 35 years ago, you wonder, if he concluded that in 1982, you wonder what President Reagan would think about the state of America today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on another week of broadcasting. Send us an email. I'm talking to you. Send one this weekend. td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today and all week. We'll see you next week.